Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a weekly podcast to keep you up to date on what's new on our cloud platform, Microsoft Azure. Your hosts, Cynthia Crane, Evan Basilik, Suji DeMello, Kendall Roden, Kel Teeter, and Russell Young discuss a different service or solution on each show, with subject matter experts to explain how to get started, how different services work, and how to make decisions in tricky scenarios. You can find out more about our podcast at azpodcast.com or follow us on Twitter at Azure Podcast.
Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 394, being recorded on the 15th of September, 2021, with special guest Maria Mihailova. I'm Sajid, and on Teams with me, I have, of course, our special guest Maria, Kale, and Cynthia. And we're going to get to our special guest in just a minute on a really interesting topic, which we haven't covered in a while. So looking forward to getting the latest update on that. But before that, let's look into some of the news in Azure this week. And I believe, Kale, you put a few things, as did Cynthia, Kale, and I have some to cover as well. I think Evan is not here today, but he put some, which I'll cover.
Yeah, sure. I got three of them here today. So the first one is about the well-architected framework, kind of practices and patterns and things like that that we've kind of built over the years. And, you know, we've talked about this a few times in the news and on the podcast. I think we even had some guests on about this. But essentially, the thing I wanted to call out here for our listeners is on September 23rd this month, there's online on this Learn TV. We're going to have, you know, some presentations there and kind of behind the scenes of the framework documentation. I think Mark Rusinovich is going to be delivering the opening address for that. So feel free to we'll drop the link in the notes, but you can RSVP to that. It's online, so there's no like in-person thing. And there's a write-up there about some of the different sessions that are going to be talked about: cost optimization, security, reliability, with various representatives from Microsoft, from PMs and engineering in there. Totally free, so check it out. Second thing was around video analytics. I think we talked about this one a few times too, and also with our discussions around 5G that we've had a few episodes on, the Azure for Operators, if you go back and look at that podcast we had. And in here, this is basically talking about, you know, the analytics platforms that we've built there, primarily that help in the 4G, 5G space. And, you know, the investments that we're making in there, various, you know, partners we're working with. I think there's even some case studies in there on this, which is really cool. So if you're in that space and building around large scale live video feeds, things like that, which the Azure podcast someday will be a live feed. Just kidding. But, you know, we have some really good stuff there in our Azure Video Analyzer, Azure Arc. This Microsoft Rocket, which I don't know too much about, we might need to, you know, have a podcast about that when to dig into that one, because I don't know too much about Microsoft Rocket, but it sounds really neat, the open source platform for video processing. And then the last one was around, this is more traditional one around just some services in Azure. It was around the Azure Firewall. So there's been some updates in August, so we're in September now, but it was you know, just last month. And there's some new features there, regional expansion, some things around premium SKU for certificates, availability zones things, and some things around public IPs like force tunneling and not. So if you're using Azure Firewall or interested in that, take a look. There's some new enhancements there. That's all I got.
That's great. I have a couple that Evan actually put in there, so I'll cover them for him. So the first one was about the Azure Disk Storage. And now what's generally available is the zone redundant storage. So instead of being limited to just being locally redundant in a data center, it's redundant across all of the data centers in the region, and that should make them much more highly available. So that's one thing to look forward to. The second one, which is particularly close to me, I know Kendall would have loved to talk about it if she were here today, and that is about AKS, the scale-down mode in AKS. As you know, AKS has a way where you can scale up and scale down, but the problem is when you scale down, your node underneath is completely allocated, you know, the storage is gone. And when you have to scale up again, it's got to have to recreate that node from scratch all over again. And so now there is a new feature in AKS where you can say, hey, when you scale down, get rid of the node, but don't delete it completely, right? Don't delete all the storage associated with it. Next time when it comes, when you think you need to scale up, now it's a lot faster because you're just spinning up the node and the storage is already ready to go. And you can be up and running in just maybe a couple of minutes instead of the 5 or 10 minutes that it takes today. So I think this is a good service to have because you still save money by not having the VM running. Of course, there's a few pennies that you have to spend for the storage to keep that going, but for the most part, you're meeting your price goals over there.
So Gene, is that like akin to what we had a long time ago with VMs, where we would shut them down versus deallocate them type thing?
Exactly. It's just done automatically through the scaling mechanism in AKS now, so because you normally don't have access to that feature manually. It's done by behind the covers mm-hmm. when AKS fields needs to scale up and scale down. And so there's a flag that you can turn that on now.
Nice.
Well, Cynthia, do you have anything or should we just get to our special guest? Okay, sounds good. Well, again, thank you, Maria, for reaching out to us to talk about your favorite topic. So please first introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us what you do at Microsoft. We'll take them there.
Yeah, thank you for having me. So my name is Maria Mikhailova. I'm a principal software engineer at Microsoft Quantum. In a nutshell, Microsoft Quantum is working on building a full-stack quantum computing system and the ecosystem around it. So all the layers from quantum hardware to algorithms and applications. Myself, I'm on the very top of the stack. I drive our education and outreach work. So helping people learn quantum computing using our tools, helping people learn our tools, and ideally making these learnings exciting.
So, I wanted to ask you, what is, as a developer, I'm a C# developer, for example, and I'm sure, Kayla and Cynthia have their own special languages as well. But for a developer, what's the hardest thing to get over if you want to get into quantum computing?
The hardest thing to get over is probably the reputation that quantum computing acquired over the years. So if you just kind of think about what you've heard about it, probably subconsciously, you probably think that it's like scary and hard. It's actually not. Under the hood, it's all linear algebra. And it's really not the worst branch of mathematics you could work with. Linear algebra and a bit of probability theory. So somehow, over the years, it acquired the reputation of being inaccessible and spooky and whatnot. So this thing is what I suspect just keeps a lot of people back from learning it and understanding it and just being comfortable with it. Once you've stepped over this, everything else is just technical stuff. It's easy.
Okay, so I have a question because I've asked someone about this and they try to explain qubit to me. So in quantum computing, do bits not exist anymore and everything is in the unit of qubits?
That's a new way to pose this question. So bits still exist, but they exist in a different capacity. Bits are no longer the main way you perform your computations. Instead, they are the way you are getting the output of your computations. And your computation is done using qubits. Qubits are basically the things that carry out your computation for you. They are really interesting because they're not just kind of different type of memory. They are actually what carries out your computation based on the instructions you provide to them. But if you think about them as memory, you probably heard this idea that a bit has only two states, 0 and 1, and a qubit has also the superposition states. It means it can be in any state between 0 and 1. If you think about it as a circle on a plane, you have horizontal, you have vertical. But that's in classical. In quantum, you also have all the states between. So this is a very unhelpful description of what a qubit is. The really interesting things happen when you have multiple qubits, because then you can act on states of multiple qubits that are also between all the basis states, linear combinations of the basis states. And then you can have all kinds of interesting things when you measure the results and when you manipulate them and you have something that looks very much like negative probabilities. They're not actually negative probabilities, but basically probabilities of different states can cancel out. So once you get over this, it's really easier to do it with pen and paper and some precise math than by just talking. But once you get over this, the idea behind quantum computing is that your algorithm manipulates the state of your qubits cleverly, so that in the end of the algorithm, you do your measurement, you read out the information from the state of your program, and you get the right answer with a high probability, because the incorrect answer's probabilities kind of cancel each other out.
Yeah, so I had another question, too, that kind of follow on to what Sajit had mentioned earlier. So thinking a little bit more high level, less directly on qubits and some of the low-level internals, like, where does what should I think about from, like, a workload perspective? Like, obviously, I don't think it's, like, something where I'm going to run my website using quantum computers behind the scenes, you know, to surface up a marketing site or something like that. But what should I think about? Like, what are the sweet spots for, like, hey, if you have a workload that meets this kind of criteria, quantum is like a powerhouse that can really help you?
Excellent question. A very commonly held misconception is that quantum computing is going to overtake everything and replace classical computing, and you're even going to check your email using it. Not going to happen. Let's just stick with Outlook. So the sweet spot for quantum computing are things that classical computers are bad at. Classical computers are decent at checking emails. Quantum computing is good for things in which you have a little input, then you have massive computation to be done on that input, and then you have a little output. A great example is quantum chemistry. It's simulating the properties of molecules and materials based on the information about their composition. So it takes relatively little information, because you basically tell what atoms are in the molecule, what are the distances between them, that kind of things. So it's not a huge amount of data. But then to simulate something like the energy of the ground state of this molecule, it actually takes a pretty big computation. And the size of this computation grows very fast as your molecule becomes more complicated. So, for example, classical computers can model caffeine, really important molecule, right? They can do it perfectly because it's small enough. Once you go to slightly larger molecules that have, for example, metals in them, things become much more complicated and classical computers cannot model them any longer. And you need to model these for all kinds of applications, like fertilizers, like medical applications, like coming up with new materials. And this is something that quantum computers, we expect, are going to be good at doing, because of this kind of, the algorithms for quantum computers are different because there is this affinity between the quantum processes in the molecules and the quantum processes you're relying on for performing your computation. That's one example.
You know, Maria, when you described earlier about how I think you were answering Cynthia's question about you know, how you would actually run one of these programs, and you said that you know, the outcome has a higher you have a high probability of getting the correct answer on the outcome. I think that's how you explained it, right? Because all the incorrect answers kind of cancel each other out, and that is one of the, you know, again, that goes back to the question I was asking. That's like difficult for me to wrap my hands around, right? Because when I write a program, I want to know that I got the answer, and what you're explaining is that, you know, there's a high you have a high probability of getting the right answer or something of that nature. And that's like, I want to try and understand, like, you know, how does that change how developers should think about, you know, approaching writing a quantum computing program? If I have a traditional program, maybe it's I think of neural networks or something like that, right? As a kind of a classic example of a complicated algorithm, and I want to do that in using quantum computing. What's the mindset change that's required over there?
If you have only worked with deterministic programs before, there is going to be some mindset adaptation required. But there is a class of algorithms that is probabilistic inherently, even so they are completely classical. So you just basically you don't trust the first answer you get. You run the program a couple times more and you pick whatever answer is most frequent one. That's a very simplified version, but it's not that conceptually different from classical probabilistic algorithms.
Awesome. Maybe you could talk a little bit about kind of how we develop on top of this. Has Microsoft created like their own language? What sort of pieces are kind of open source here in that space? Like, how are the communities and Microsoft working to push quantum forward? And how can I like start writing code for this on these platforms?
Oh, this is a big question. The one. Yeah. Okay. I will fit the answer in the rest of the time we have. Okay. So. What does the workflow of developing a quantum application look like? And then I will segue into answering the rest of them. So there are a couple of main pieces that go into it. So first, you develop your program kind of locally on your computer, same as in classical computing. For this, Microsoft has a set of tools called Microsoft Quantum Development Kit and a programming language called Q-Sharp. It's a domain-specific language. It has very limited capabilities for classical computing. For example, you cannot read a file using it. It's very targeted specifically at quantum computing algorithms. So you write your program using Q-Sharp. Then you run some validations on it. And one very interesting tool that comes as part of Quantum Development Kit are quantum simulators. Those are classical programs that behave like a small quantum device. So they can simulate the behavior of your program without actually hitting quantum hardware, which is really convenient because this means that using your old laptop, you can run programs that take up to 30 qubits. And this means that you can do neat software engineering things like developing unit tests, right? We all know that it's an important part of our software engineering practices. And this is something you want to do for quantum computing as well. Especially since your results can be probabilistic, you want to verify as much things as possible locally. Now, the next step, once you have convinced yourself that your program is correct, you use another tool called resource estimation. You run your program through it to figure out how much hardware resources it's going to need, how many qubits, and how long your computation is going to take. Basically, current hardware systems are first small and second prone to noise. So if the computation is too long, it's just going to be messed up by the noise. So by the end of it, you're not going to get a useful result, unfortunately. That's the negative thing about being so early in this quantum computing space. The hardware systems are just too small and too noisy right now to give an actual practical advantage, but they're great for research. So once you have convinced yourself that your program is correct and it can run with the hardware that you have access to, you go to Azure Quantum, and the last step is running your program on actual quantum hardware using the cloud, Azure Quantum. We have a couple of hardware providers right now, IonQ and Honeywell. So you have your pick of how you want to run your program. So in this workflow, which pieces are open source? Pretty much everything until you hit Azure Quantum is open source. So Quantum Development Kit is open source. Q-sharp language and specification, the simulators, the learning materials, pretty much everything there is open source. And how you can get started with writing your quantum code, I believe that was the last piece of the question. We have a lot of great learning materials. We have MSLearn modules that help you get started on the quantum computing path. And we have a dedicated project that is my brainchild. It's called the Quantum Katas. They are basically a collection of tutorials that come with programming exercises. So you get the theory and then you get the programming exercise. And when you write your code, the tutorial gives you feedback. So it tells you whether your solution is correct or not. And again, you know how important it is to get feedback when you're learning, especially if you're doing it on your own. Actually, when I started learning quantum computing, we didn't have any of those programming tools. We didn't have the quantum katas, of course. So the learning at that point looked like, here's the book, read it, good luck. Really hard to learn things that way. So when I got to the point of exercises in that book, I would have to basically set up an ambush at the kitchen. It was a couple years ago, so meeting people in the kitchen of your office was actually a thing. And I had to wait until an actual quantum computing researcher would wander into the kitchen. And I was like, oh, hey, you're a computing researcher, right? Certainly you know the answer to this exercise. It's not something that every learner can do, especially if they don't have places with high traffic of quantum computing researchers nearby. So that's actually how I came up with this idea, something that would give you the feedback for your solutions automatically.
So, Maria, I really hope to be in one area with high traffic of quantum researchers. That sounds like a cool place to be. But I've heard that quantum can help in things like in the pharmaceutical industry, that it helps with development of drugs, that the computation is a lot faster or things can be done in parallel. Can we understand that information? Like, what about quantum that makes these computations faster?
Fundamentally, it's that thing that I mentioned before, that you kind of consider multiple options at once. It's the superposition thing. Then you manipulate those options so that the ones you're looking for have higher probability than the ones that are not answers to your problem. It's really tempting to say that it's just considering everything at once, but that's not entirely correct, because the way quantum measurements work, you can kind of consider everything at once, but you wouldn't be able to get all the outputs for every input. You're going to just get the output for one random input. So instead, you need to have this algorithm that's going to manipulate your inputs cleverly to achieve this cancellation. It's called interference. Some things canceling out and other things amplifying each other.
And a question about the dev environment, too. So, like, as you talk about, like, hey, you build your stuff locally, you kind of test it and things like that, and then eventually you work your way up to actually running it on quantum hardware. What happens, so like I assume like at the production scale, like once you get up into quantum hardware, this is where your actual simulations or whatever you're running your code on is happening there. The question I have is like, what happens when things like crash there? And what I mean by that, like let's say we had a bug in our program or something. What's like the debugging experience like for quantum? Is it like vastly different from like, you know, I'm used to, you know, using Visual Studio or VS Code, we can set breakpoints, we can look at things. Can we do the same thing in quantum, or is it like, no, there's a whole new way to do debugging like thing?
Definitely a whole new way. So the thing about quantum computing that makes it really, really hard to debug. First, the way it works physically is that you have this very complicated system in superposition state. But if you try to look at it, because that's what you want to do when debugging, right? You want to see what's going on. When you look at it, the system is actually fragile. It's not going to show you what's inside it. Instead, it's going to collapse. It's the way the physical process works. It's going to destruct this superposition state. It's going to become just one of the components of this state. And it will show you just this one component. So basically, if you have this incorrect superposition state, you're not going to be ever able to observe it. Makes debugging a pain. True. So that's why we want to emphasize the local development so much. Because when you're developing locally on a simulator, the simulator is a classical program. It pretends to be a quantum device, but underneath it's a classical program. So it can tell you everything about the program, including things you wouldn't be able to observe physically. So when you're running on a simulation, you can use parts of this experience, Visual Studio and breakpoints, yes. And it can show you the quantum state at these points. Once we are hitting the hardware, it's going to be really hard to debug. There are some research directions about how to actually gather information if something went wrong. But this is a research area, not something that we have a ready-made answer for you yet.
And real quick, I noticed you got your hand up, but I just had one follow-up question to that. Like, the compute that's used, and I don't even know if we know the answer to this. Anybody knows, that's why I just want to ask it. Like, when I look at, like, traditional compute or even, like, a GPU today, they behave a certain way under certain conditions, right? Like, as you mentioned before, right? So, like, the heat, right? So the heat inside the computer will actually affect, like, how the compute works, right? And if it gets too high, things start to break down, right? We start getting errors or other things will happen. Is that, like, what is happening with quantum, like, today to kind of make it stable? Because it's, like, for instance, I assume, like, if you're running some big, like, cancer calculation or, like, Cynthia mentioned, like, some new drug development or molecules and things like that, that's going to take a long time to run, probably. It's going to be a lot of data, and that's probably going to develop significant, I guess, heat. I guess the question is, like, is that where a lot of research going in to make that stable? So it's just like a light switch, like, hey, here's my program. 2 hours later, I come back, I get the output. And, you know, is it really finicky, like, with that kind of stuff?
Oh, yes. It's so much more fragile than the classical compute at this point. So qubits can have multiple physical implementations. Different companies pursue different things usually. But all of them are incredibly sensitive to environment settings, environment noise, like air conditioning turning on and off in a room in which your fridge sits can impact your computation. Terrible stuff, really. So that's where a lot of hardware research is going into right now, figuring out ways to make the qubits more stable, less sensitive to that external noise, and to make them scalable. So right now, the biggest systems in the world have less than 100 qubits, I think. And to have your real practical impact, you want to have millions and tens of millions. And building a system that can have that many qubits and have them with low noise so that you can actually carry out your 2-hour-long computation is a lot of challenges.
Maria, one of the things that I've heard, and maybe it's just science fiction here, but I've heard that if the bad guys get a hold of a quantum computer, they could crack like an RSA algorithm or something very quickly. You know, it's got that power to do something bad like that. I know that, you know, when we dealt with AI and ML, we had to put a certain ethical boundaries around, you know, how we use that sort of technology. Are you guys thinking about that in a similar way when it comes to quantum computing? Like, you know, is there like an ethical way to use quantum computing?
There definitely are some dangers to it. You can use pretty much anything unethically, right? Specifically for this question, the RSA breaking, this is unfortunately not fiction. With a big enough and stable enough quantum computer, you can break RSA. This is why there are researchers who look into coming up with new schemes for making things secure that would be resilient to quantum computers. I think there is actually a team in Microsoft who is looking into this.
Awesome. Well, I mean, what are your kind of go-to action for this? Like, what should our listeners do first? Like, where should they go to try this out?
The best place to go is Azure Quantum website, azure.com/quantum, I believe, which is the entry point to read more about all the great work that Microsoft is doing, and also a pointer to our learning materials, of course, if you want to, you know, dive in and get your hands dirty and start actually writing quantum code. There are pointers there. And personally, I believe the quantum katas are great. At least that's what people tell me.
Sure they are. And I know you said it was a good open source community around this. Is that where you and your team will often go to answer questions and things like that? How can they, you know, developers get, I'm sure they have, like, you know, all those newbie questions coming out with something new like this. What's their avenue for getting help in these areas?
Yeah, we definitely are working on building a community around our tools. It would be sort of silly to have a functioning quantum computer and great software tools for them, but nobody actually being able to use them. So everybody is most welcome on our open source repositories. We watch Quantum Computing Stack Exchange, for example, in which people often come and ask questions about GitHub. So those kinds of avenues. We also sometimes do events in which we kind of engage the community a bit closer. The one that's coming up is going to be Hacktoberfest. Having some good first issues for people to contribute to our open source repositories.
I just have one, like, future thinking question for you. If you were to look into the future and say, you know, when is the point in time where I would be able to have a quantum computer right back there by my wall, maybe a small quantum computer, when would that become a reality? Like, how many years into the future are we talking about?
Well, you know what they say, prediction is hard, especially about the future. Right now, our thinking is that quantum computers are going to remain in the cloud for a good long time. This lovely screen, the background that I have, is actually a lab in one of our European labs. And that's kind of what it looks like to have a fridge that has a very small quantum computer potentially sitting in it.
Is that liquid nitrogen next to it? The two tanks?
Quite possibly. They never allowed me to look inside, which is very wise. Yeah, I'm a very software person. So having something like that sitting in your bedroom first requires a seriously big bedroom. And second, it's expensive and it's fragile and it has a lot of maintenance going into it. So having it somewhere in a dedicated lab and giving you cloud access to it is pretty much the best way to do it. Same as supercomputers don't sit in people's spare bedrooms. They sit somewhere and they get access via cloud.
I thought that's what the Xbox mini fridge was, Sajid. I thought that was like for quantum. Just kidding.
That's good. That's a great answer. Thank you so much, Maria. Well, if you have, we'll take all the links and, you know, resources that you have to share with our listeners, including all the work that you've done to make the learning easier, and we'll put it along with the show notes. So feel free to send everything my way.
Sounds good.
All right, and thank you so much for reaching out again and taking the time to explain to us mere mortals what quantum computing is all about. You know, we don't hang out with the cool quantum scientists and researchers. So this is our way of trying to learn.
Thank you for having me. It was a great chat.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any thoughts, questions, or just want to connect, find us on Twitter at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixer.org under the Creative Commons license. We hope you'll tune in again soon to keep learning with us.